Hello, I'm Mitch Oswald, a graduate student in the Education Outreach Department at Croesus. I got my undergraduate here at KU in Atmospheric Science in 2006. Now I'm working in the Educational Outreach Department here at Croesus. But today we're going to talk about energy balance and circulation systems and how that relates to climate. What I always like to do when I give these present when I give any presentation, really, is my second slide is always titled The Importance Slide. I like to call that Why Do We Care? So why do we care about the energy balance and why do we care about circulation systems? The reason these are important is because energy that we receive from the sun through the energy budget, it drives the Earth's atmosphere. And it creates the circulation systems that we have that create our weather and climate. Basically, what happens is we receive energy from the sun. Something to remember throughout this lecture is that the Earth's atmosphere is always trying to balance itself out. It's always trying to get into a state of equilibrium. So we receive the energy from the sun, and then it is redistributed throughout the Earth through the atmosphere, through atmospheric circulations, and through ocean circulations. And that's what causes our circulation systems that we will talk about later. This is what affects our weather, creates our weather, and creates the climate in which we live. So let's go ahead and take a look at our energy budget. In the next few slides, we'll kind of address that. First, we'll take a look at the solar radiation actually entering the atmosphere. You'll notice at the top of the figure we have that is the solar radiation, the amount coming in at the top of the atmosphere. As it moves through the atmosphere, we have about 19% that is absorbed by gases and clouds within the atmosphere. And that 19% goes into heating the atmosphere. And the main gases which absorb this we will be talking about are the greenhouse gases, and we'll be talking about their impact later. A lot of them are opaque to this, but they do absorb some of the radiation which enters and it does heat up the atmosphere. Another issue that we see in the atmosphere is that it is scattered and reflected by gas molecules, clouds, aerosols, and the Earth's surface. And you'll notice that due to this absorption, this scattering, and reflection, you'll see at the bottom of the figure that only about 51% of the solar radiation that enters the top of the atmosphere actually reaches the surface and is absorbed by the surface. We do have 30%, as I said, that is scattered and reflected from the Earth's surface and the atmosphere. And that's what we call albedo. That is the amount of reflectivity that is at the surface. Now, albedo, the actual scientific definition of albedo, it is the percent of radiation returning from a surface compared to the amount of radiation initially striking the surface. So in other words, it's the reflectivity of the surface, the amount of radiation that is reflected from a surface. And this really varies depending on which surface you're talking about. If you're talking about fresh snow, you're looking at an albedo of about 95%. So 95% of the radiation which strikes that surface will be reflected and only 5% is actually absorbed. If you're talking about a dark soil, you're looking about 5 to 10%. So in that case, you're looking at about 90% absorption. And the 30% I alluded to before is basically the average combined albedo of the Earth and the atmosphere together. And that's what reflects that 30% back out into space, into the atmosphere. So here's a nice table showing the albedo, just to kind of give you an idea of how it varies depending on surface. You'll see down in the snow category, you see fresh snow is about 95%. Older snow, which typically has some dirt on it, drops down to about 40%. And you look at soil and water, these are mainly the two lower albedo categories that are referred to the most. Water varies, it's about 3 to 10%. And soil's anywhere from about 5 to 40% depending on its texture, whether it's dark and wet or whether it's that light, dry, sandy soil. So we take a little closer look at the Earth's energy balance, and we'll notice that first of all, the Earth's overall average temperature changes only a little bit from year to year. We don't really notice a big warm-up or a big cool-down. And this is because of the balance of the energy budget. There's a balance that actually exists between incoming shortwave solar radiation and the outgoing energy that the Earth re-radiates back to space through longwave radiation. And you'll see here we have radiation that is coming in from the sun, comes through the atmosphere. We start out at the top of the atmosphere with 100 units. When it finally does reach the surface, only 51 units are actually absorbed. And you'll notice there as you go down that 19 units are absorbed by the atmosphere. Now, of the 51 units that are absorbed at the surface, 23 of those units are returned to the atmosphere through latent heat of evaporation. 7 of those units return to the atmosphere through convection and conduction. Now, you'll notice that down at the bottom there, 117 units return back to the atmosphere through infrared long-wave radiation. You might say, well, this doesn't quite work out. We only started with 51 units. How in the world did we end up with 117 going back out? Well, you'll notice over there on the right that 96 units are radiated through infrared long-wave radiation from the atmosphere back to the surface. So there is an absorption of long-wave radiation at the surface of 96 units. And this is due to that absorption of solar radiation in the atmosphere plus absorption and emission of the infrared energy, which the Earth kicks back into the atmosphere. Not most of that, you'll notice only 6 units of that actually go back out in space, so 111 of those units are absorbed by the atmosphere and then re-emitted back to the Earth. So we see that the gases in the atmosphere and the clouds, water vapors, things like CO2 and methane kind of act as a blanket, these greenhouse gases, and they help to keep us warmer than we otherwise would be. But overall, you see, clear down at the bottom, you'll see that the energy lost at the surface is the same as the energy gained. 147 units are gained at the surface and 147 units are lost. And there's a balance in the atmosphere as well. The energy lost by the atmosphere is 160 units, but it gains 160 units from solar radiation and from long-wave terrestrial radiation. So we have a balance in the Earth's energy budget. Now, if we had a balance, there wouldn't be much of a need for redistribution because the atmosphere would be balanced. And we said before that these circulation systems arise because the atmosphere wants to achieve a balance. And the reason we get an imbalance of energy is because something that we call differential heating. Basically, the energy received at any location on the Earth is going to vary depending on the latitude at which you are at. This graphic here is shows a typical path of the sun at the middle latitudes, about 40 degrees north. You'll notice that our sun angle, our zenith angle, varies depending on what season we're in. In June, we receive more direct radiation, so obviously we're going to be warmer. In December, the sun's lower in the sky. So radiation will be less direct. We will not be as warm. This is what we call differential heating, and it varies with respect to latitude. So the energy which we actually receive at surface depends on the sun angle with respect to the surface and the path of solar radiation through the atmosphere. So as you move towards the poles, you will see less direct solar radiation. Therefore, overall, throughout the year, you will be cooler. The equator, we have more direct radiation. So overall, throughout the year, you will be warmer. You'll receive more energy at the equator than you will at the poles. And that's why we have all of our ice, and that's why our poles are cooler, because there's less direct radiation at those locations. Here's an example showing how this actually happens. You'll notice here we have our sun, or a light bulb. We have radiation emitted from that. Let's say this light emits 342 watts, and it is incident on an area that is 1 square meter. So you'll notice on the left there, we have our radiation striking our surface over our 1 square meter. We have 342 watts per square meter. Now, if we project that light at an angle, at a 45-degree angle in this case, we still have 342 watts emanating from this bulb. But because it's at an angle, it is spread out over a larger area. In this case, it's spread out over 1.41 square meters. Therefore, you take 342 divided by 1.41, and you get your 242 watts per square meter. So we have less intense radiation at that location than we would at the location on the left, where it is more direct. So there'd be more energy available at the location on the left than there will be at the location on the right. This is called differential heating, and this is what we see as we move towards the poles. We see the situation on the right where the energy is spread out over a larger area, and so we have less energy available. Here's an example showing that. This is actually the Earth in the northern hemispheric summer, where we're tilted at about 23.5 degrees. But you'll notice here that as you move towards the poles, even in the summer, you'll see that this radiation is at an angle. The radiation on the right that is coming from the sun is spread out over a larger area. You see that there's more direct radiation striking the surface. In other words, you have the same amount of radiation over a smaller and smaller surface as we reach the equator. It's more direct at these latitudes, at these equatorial latitudes. And as we move north and south away from the equator, we see less direct radiation. So what this amounts to is that you have more energy at lower latitudes around the equatorial region than you do as you move towards the poles in higher latitudes. So what we end up with is an unequal distribution due to this differential heating. An incoming solar radiation, which in this diagram is in red, and the outgoing Earth radiation, which is in blue. So between about 37 degrees north and 37 degrees south, we see that these locations have a surplus of solar radiation, of incoming radiation. In other words, they receive more radiation from the sun than the Earth radiates out. So there's a net surplus of energy between these latitudes. As we move beyond those 37 degrees north and south, there is a deficit in radiation, so the Earth is actually radiating away more long-wave energy than these locations are receiving from the sun. Because the atmosphere always wants to be in balance, we see this heat transfer between the lower latitudes and higher latitudes. And so what we have is energy moving from the equator towards the poles, and it is through atmospheric circulations and ocean circulations. And that's why these circulations come about, is because of this heat transfer and this strive towards perfect balance that the atmosphere wants to be in, but never actually reaches. If it did, then everything would kind of shut down and we'd live in a boring world. So let's take a look at our atmospheric circulations, my favorite topic, being that I'm a meteorologist. What we see set up is, as we get heating at the equator, we get warmer air. Warmer air is more buoyant than cold air, just like warmer water is more buoyant than colder water. And so as we receive this extra energy and we warm the air, it begins to rise. And as it rises, it begins to move northward. It rises and moves northward. As it moves northward, it radiates off its energy, redistributing that heat or giving that heat back to these cooler latitudes, and until it reaches a point in which it is cool enough that it can sink. That occurs around 30 degrees north, and you'll notice in the figure on the right, this rising at the equator and sinking around 30 degrees north and 30 degrees south. Is what we call the Hadley cell. It is a circulation cell. It is a permanent circulation cell that sets up and helps to redistribute this heat from the equator to these locations. Now, as this air sinks, some of it returns back southward to the equator to be reheated again, or I should say it returns northward as well from the southern hemisphere. Some of it continues farther north past the 30-degree latitudes, on up into higher latitudes yet, reaching about 60 degrees north. before it finally encounters extremely cold air, in which it is very hard to mix. It doesn't mix readily with this air, and most of that returns back southward, actually, in the cell that we call the feral cell. It returns back southward, it cools, and then it will sink and return eventually through the Hadley cell circulation back to the equator. Now, there is a little bit of this air in the feral cell that does make it past this boundary between this extremely cold polar air and the air at about 60 degrees. This boundary is called the polar front. It's hard to penetrate, but some of this air does make it through and will actually make it to the poles before radiating off even more of its heat and energy. And at that point, it will sink and return back, eventually making it all the way back to the equator. So when we look at the Hadley and Feral cells, and we say that these circulations are permanent, in all science, what we want to do is say, well, how do we know for sure that these are actually is actually what's happening? How do we know that this Hadley cell is actually and the Feral cell are actually occurring? Well, we can look at that fairly easily, actually. Good proof of the Hadley cell is just in the way that our climate is set up across the Earth in our different types of formations that we have on land. You'll notice here in this graphic, most of our rainforests that we see, in fact, just about all of them are actually our tropical rainforests anyway, are right along the equator, where we see this rising motion of the Hadley cell due to that heated air. As air rises, that's when we get our clouds and that's when we get our rain. And so there is an abundant amount of rainfall at these latitudes. This air moves northward, loses its heat, and cools, and then becomes more dense and sinks at about 30 degrees north. Sinking air is synonymous with high pressure, which is synonymous with fair weather, clear skies, and little rain. And we see that most of our deserts on the Earth are actually line up right along a line of 30 degrees north and south. So we know that the Hadley cell is indeed working on the Earth, and it is a permanent feature because these areas have been deserts for a fairly long period of time. So when we look at our atmospheric circulations, you'll notice on the graphic on the left that we have our winds, but this actually showing surface winds. Our surface winds are not straight north and south. I mean, we said that our air rises at the equator, moves northward, cools, and then moves back towards the equator. Well, these winds are not straight north and south, so why do we end up with the easterlies and the westerlies that are shown in this map, our trade winds? Well, it's due to a little factor called the Coriolis force, or Coriolis effect. This is actually an apparent force. It's not a real force, but it's an apparent force that comes about due to the rotation of the Earth. A good example of this is the graphic that's shown on the left there. Suppose you're sitting on a platform, a non-rotating platform, and you've got a friend on the other side. You've got a ball in your hand, and you want to throw that ball to your friend. So you throw that ball across the platform to your friend. It follows a straight line, goes right to him, and they catch it. You'll notice on the bottom left there, that is the view from an observer standing off of the platform. They see the ball follow a straight line, as does an observer in the top left who is above your platform watching you. They see the ball go in a straight line. Now, if we set this platform into rotation and your friend begins to move by you towards the left and you throw the ball to where they are at, by the time the ball reaches that location, your friend will have moved a certain distance on this rotating platform. So although the ball follows a straight line, to you it appears to curve because your friend is actually moving out of the way of the ball. So it looks like you have a curvature that your ball actually curves to the right of its motion. Even though it still is following a straight line, as can be seen by the top right and bottom right diagrams, in which you are an observer, from an observer's point of view, actually off of the platform, standing off of the platform. So the ball still follows a straight line, but it's the rotation that makes it appear to curve. And we see this with the winds on the Earth because they don't really have a lot of frictional contact with the Earth's surface. And so in the northern hemisphere, our winds are actually deflected to the right of their motion. In the southern hemisphere, our winds are deflected to the left of their motion. And that's how we get this that's why we don't see our north and south directed winds, because they are deflected by the rotation of the Earth through the Coriolis force. Now, this Coriolis force, the deflection of it, it depends on what latitudes you're at, how big of an effect that this will have. We see greater deviations, in other words, greater curvature as we move towards the poles. We see no deviation at the equator. Now, here's an example where on the left you have three airplanes flying at different latitudes, one at zero right at the equator, one at 30 degrees north, and one at 60 degrees north. The airplane at 60 degrees north, if they don't correct, will have a very large deviation from their intended target because the Earth is rotating underneath them. The one at 30 degrees north will have a smaller deviation, and the one at the equator will have no deviation because it is moving right along with the rotation of the Earth. So we see greater deviation in the Coriolis force, greater deflection as we move towards the poles. And that's why we get these easterlies, these westerlies, and these trade winds. Again, this diagram on the left shows only the surface winds. So we can see as we sink at 30 degrees north, as this air sinks along the Hadley cell and begins to move back towards the equator, it is deflected to the right of its motion, and this is where we get our trade winds in the northern hemisphere, our southwesterly trade winds. In the southern hemisphere, we have another Hadley cell working as it sinks at 30 degrees south, and these winds return along the surface towards the equator. We get our northwesterly trade winds between 30 degrees south and the equator. There is a convergence. These winds meet at the equator or right around it. And when they meet and we have this convergence and they get heated, they rise again to repeat the Hadley cell. And we see this area of maximum convergence along this red line marked ITCZ, and that stands for the Intertropical Convergence Zone. This is where we see the most intense rainfall and the greatest amount of precipitation. And this does migrate depending on what season you're in. The area that is receiving the most intense radiation, that is the location that the ITCZ will be at. So when we're in the summer, for summer in the northern hemisphere, the ITCZ will move to around 20 degrees north. And when it's summer in the southern hemisphere, the ITCZ will move to around 20 degrees south. But it never moves any farther than 20 degrees north or south. It won't move to any more higher latitudes than that, because of the Earth's tilt. The Earth only tilts 23 degrees. You'll notice as we move up into the subtropical region, past 30 degrees north, we have the first leg of the Farrell cell there. As these winds move northward, they're deflected to the right, and it's the opposite in the southern hemisphere. So that's where we get these different directional winds, and that's how we get them to set up. Now, I mentioned before that the ITCZ does migrate depending on season. You'll notice here's an example of January in the northern hemisphere, which is summer in the southern hemisphere. More direct, intense radiation, about 20 degrees south. And so the ITCZ migrates down there. And this is where we get our monsoons, where some locations receive their wet seasons. I know in our summer, which we have an example in the bottom of July, which is not a very good example. It's right at the equator at this point. But if we were to show this in June, it would be farther north, about 20 degrees north. And this is where you see the wet seasons in the Sahara, because our ITCZ is farther north, and you get a brief period of fairly consistent and heavy rain at that point. Another thing to notice on these two graphics is that due to the differentiation of the tilt of the Earth, how it varies from season to season, and depending on where the most direct radiation is, we get these semi-permanent weather systems that set up in our winter. The winter in the northern hemisphere, we see the Aleutian low that sets up. We also see the Siberian high, which keeps Russia fairly dry, or at least that part of the world fairly dry during the winter and very cold. The Icelandic low is another one that sets up in our winter as well, and that's all due to the change in radiation in our hemisphere. So this plays a large role in our weather and in our climate year to year. So I'm going to take a look at ocean circulations. You look at ocean circulations, they're trying to do the same thing as atmospheric circulations. They're trying to achieve balance. They're part of the whole climate system, and it's always trying to balance itself out. You see, as the water is warmed at the equator, it begins to move northward, redistributing its heat to the atmosphere. One of the major currents that affects the United States is the Gulf Stream, which runs up the east coast there. You'll see it originates at the equator, moves up. Part of it branches off in the Gulf of Mexico and then reconnects back over, and it flows up the east coast of the United States. Continues on up towards the United Kingdom before it finally cools enough to where it becomes dense enough to sink. Then it returns. It sinks towards the bottom of the ocean, returns back to the equator where it's heated, rises again, and flows back northward. Now this chart here only shows surface current, but you'll notice that, and we'll show it just here in another minute with the next graphic, an interesting outcome of this Gulf Stream that flows up from the equator, and this occurs in other parts of the world too, is that Alaska and the United Kingdom are at roughly the same latitude, but they have very, very different climates. And this is because of the modifying effect that the warm current has on the climate there in Western Europe. Without that, the United Kingdom would be a much colder place, similar to Alaska, with the exception of the southern coast of Alaska, which most of the time tends to be warmer. That's because of the modifying current from the other circulation over there that heats its climate as well, that modifies its climate. It's more maritime and more habitable. And we see these circulations set up in the southern hemisphere as well, and they're also very important to the climate of different locations, making them more habitable than they otherwise would be. And they influence weather just as much as atmospheric circulations do. So take another look. This is a thermal haline circulation, which is a more long-term circulation. Now, to clear up any confusion that may arise, as it has arisen before when I've talked about this diagram, the red in this case represents the surface current. It is not indicative of temperature at all. The blue in this case represents the deep water formation there in the deep current that runs underneath the surface. So we're not really looking at temperature here, although I'll mention it some as we go along. The main thing we want to be concerned with the thermal haline circulation is the salinity, which is shown on the map. What we end up is we get warmer water rising at the equator, and then it moves northward, and it redistributes that heat out, but we also see it become saltier as it moves towards the poles. Moves towards the poles, becomes saltier. Saltier water is more dense, and so as it reaches the poles, it has increased salinity and sinks, and then moves back towards the equator. And you can see that some of this deep current actually moves down farther from, say, Greenland on down to Antarctica, where it finally reemerges at the surface and comes back up and is heated at the equator, and then the cycle repeats again. This is a fairly consistent current, although it is long-term across the Earth. And one of the main concerns with the thermal haline circulation, especially with the Gulf Stream in our case here in the United States, and certainly in the case of those folks in Western Europe, is that as we see melting of glaciers in Greenland, and we add more fresh water to the system, there will be less salinity gradually over a period of time. And so what that will do will hinder the deep water formation and slow down or back up, if you will, the Gulf Stream and thermal haline circulation in that region, which could have a serious impact on the habitability of the locations that are currently now seeing their climate modified by the Gulf Stream, by this warmer water. So we'll talk a little bit about greenhouse gases, and I mentioned them earlier when we were talking about the energy budget. Greenhouse gases, for all that you hear about them and how bad they are, they're actually good for us. It's when they get when we get too many of them, it's when they become they start to have some consequences. But without greenhouse gases, you'll see on the right, without any greenhouse gases, we would be a lot colder here than on the Earth's surface than we are right now. It's about a 59 degree on average temperature difference. That is because we, as I alluded to before, these greenhouse gases act as a blanket. They let most of the incoming solar radiation through. The outgoing infrared energy that the Earth re-emits, they trap, absorb most of that, and re-radiate it back to the Earth's surface. Without these greenhouse gases, any long-wave radiation we emit at the Earth's surface would just simply escape to space. So we would be a lot colder, and life would be very much different on this planet than it is otherwise. You'll see on the right, the current atmosphere, much of this infrared radiation that is released by the Earth's surface or radiated by the Earth's surface is absorbed and then re-radiated back down. So these gases act as a blanket that make our planet more inhabitable. So they are good. They are good for us. The problem is when we get too many of them and we enhance the greenhouse effect, that we start to see some consequences from them. So we take a look, and I'm not in this diagram suggesting at all that we'll ever see these numbers ever occur. But we'll take a look at what happens when we have too much greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, too many, too much CO2. For example, the early Earth was actually quite similar to Venus in that it had about, you'll notice that Venus right now has, present-day Venus has about 96.5% of its atmosphere is carbon dioxide. Now, the early Earth actually had 98% of its atmosphere made up of carbon dioxide. The difference between the Earth now and Venus now is that in between those time periods, fortunately for us, life developed on Earth. We developed what we call a biotic atmosphere. What happened is when we get our plants, our plants that developed, they took in a lot of the CO2 out of the atmosphere and actually stored it as calcium carbonate, which is not easily extractable. It's not easy to take carbon back out of that state and put it back into the atmosphere. And so because of the life which developed on Earth, our current atmosphere is only about 0.038% carbon dioxide, whereas Venus currently is 96.5%. And you'll notice the difference in temperature that this caused us. On the early Earth, it's about 290 degrees Celsius. Right now we're about 16, much more comfortable. And so you can kind of see that as we increase our greenhouse gases, it is going to correspond in some way to a temperature rise. We'll see that happen. This final slide is just an example. I mean, you can clearly see the difference. On the right, the biotic atmosphere, the planet we call home, and on the left, when you have too many greenhouse gases, you get this dirty, gassy, not very pleasant-looking atmosphere. It doesn't look like a place you want to live. So we need to keep this in mind as we move into the future and as we continue to make policies and with regard to our greenhouse gas emissions.